Belgic Confession, Article 37, the third and fourth paragraphs. And therefore the consideration of this judgment is justly terrible and dreadful to the wicked and ungodly, but most desirable and comfortable to the righteous and elect, because then their full deliverance shall be perfected, and there they shall receive the fruits of their labour and trouble which they have borne. Their innocence shall be known to all, and they shall see the terrible vengeance which God shall execute on the wicked, who most cruelly persecuted, oppressed, and tormented them in this world, and who shall be convicted by the testimony of their own consciences, and, being immortal, shall be tormented in that everlasting fire which is prepared for the devil and his angels. But on the contrary, the faithful and elect shall be crowned with glory and honour, and the Son of God will confess their names before God his Father and his elect angels. All tears shall be wiped from their eyes, and their cause, which is now condemned by many judges and magistrates as heretical and impious, will then be known to be the cause of the Son of God. And for a gracious reward, the Lord will cause them to possess such a glory as never entered into the heart of man to conceive. Tonight we're having our fifth and final class on persecution as a sign of Christ's second coming. First of all, we introduced it, this subject of persecution, towards the end of one class. And then after the introduction, we looked at the ungodly motivations for persecution. Then the forms of persecution. And last week, modern persecution. And tonight we're going to look at the effects of persecution. And that one may strike you as a little bit strange. The effects of persecution. Let's begin then by talking about the positive effects of persecution. The positive effects of persecution on earth for the church militant. And here, you could say that these positive effects are twofold. There is first the purification of the church, because unbelieving members are exposed and depart. So you will have fewer hypocrites in the church, people who claim but don't possess. Although that's also hard for the church, because many of the people are people you didn't expect. And then secondly, the persecution purifies believers because they're tested and grow. And 1 Peter 1 verse 7 is one text of many that speaks of that. So positively, the church on earth is purified by persecution. And then secondly, that refers to the church itself, the institute or the body of professing believers on the earth. Secondly, there is a godly witness in that persecution that the Lord uses to bring others to the truth. And here I think of the English Reformation martyrs, because there were more bishops, there were also sort of common people who died, but the English Reformation bishops were put to the stake, or were burned at the stake. And then in generations and even centuries later, many tracts and questions were asked along these lines. Why did the bishops lay down their lives? And it's interesting, I was writing a paper once about Hugh Latimer, and Hugh Latimer knew they were coming for him to kill him. And he was an older man, and he thought to himself, I'm not going to run away now. I'm going to actually let them catch me, because I think this is the best help I can be to the cause of Christ. And he was right. And then he said, you know, the candle, may the Lord light a candle that'll never be put out here. And that was in part the witness of their martyrdom. My guess is that you are familiar with the famous saying in this regard. The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. These are words of which church father? I'll give you a clue. It's not Augustine. Tertullian. Tertullian, yes, Ivan. Tertullian, who died around the middle of the second the 200s AD. This saying, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church, is it true, always true, sometimes true, depends? That's an open question. Let me give you one instance where it certainly does obtain and did obtain. When Stephen was stoned to death, so there's a martyr. Well, there was Paul looking after the cloaks because all that heavy heaving, you need to get your jacket off. And this Paul, first, second, third missionary journey and all the rest and the epistles. And then after his martyrdom, believers were scattered from Jerusalem and they went everywhere testifying of the grace of God, and then churches spread. So that was the case. The other famous martyr in the book of Acts, James, was killed. We referred to this in a different connection, so I mention it now with a different point in view. Then they tried to arrest Peter, and then the church was praying and so forth. So sort of there. But sometimes the church is largely wiped out. But then it gets kind of difficult. If you think about the days after Muhammad's death and the Muslim armies moving from the Middle East west across North Africa, there you've got wars. But there are also wars against infidel and Christians who are killing people. So it was persecution, a sign of the times. And it was war, a sign of the times. And then after they went through, there wasn't really much left. I mean, what about the Christian church in the 8th century in North Africa? I mean, what was there? Maybe a few scattered believers, but that's pretty much been it for over 1,000 years. And then was there prior apostasy? And then the Lord willed that sword of Islam to be his judgment upon them. But then, of course, part of it is, too, how much do we know about North Africa in the 700s? Or to be even more specific, how much do I know? Because there is more out there than I know. But I just raise this question, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. The question regarding this, because it certainly has worked out in some places, but I don't think it's always resulted in growth, never mind massive growth. It depends with God's will. I think you could say in the early church, when Tertullian lived, that was true, but then God evidently meant for the Christian church to take roots in after the apostles in the Mediterranean world. But that's something upon which different people differ. And I raise it because it's famous, because it's a famous statement about persecution, and it's a helpful thing to bear in mind in your reading and thinking in that area. Now, having talked about positive purposes of positive effects of persecution on the earth, our subject is actually tonight painful effects of persecution on the earth. That's tonight's title, painful effects of persecution. And it's not that I have a proclivity to masochism or something like that, or we love talking about pain, but this is Matthew 24 and the parallel passages. It deals with persecution, and it doesn't mention the positive things here as such. They're all painful. And so, in the great chapter on eschatology in the Gospels, with persecution as a sign of Christ's return, here in Matthew 24, verse 9 through 13, which is our central portion tonight, and also I'll be bringing in the parallel passages in Mark 13 and Luke 21. So anyway, let's begin then with the nature of persecution in Matthew 24, verse 9. I said before that the word afflicted here refers to tribulation. Then they shall deliver you up to be afflicted, or deliver you up to tribulation, and shall kill you. And ye shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. And this tribulation spoken of in the text is being pressed down and crushed with a heavy weight, which is designed to conjure up awful feelings, because that's what persecution feels like, awful. So according to Matthew 24, verse 9, Persecution includes of several things, and amongst those mentioned here, there's arrest, the authorities move in, you're led away, sometimes in handcuffs, your house has been surrounded by agents, or perhaps they take you at work, or perhaps they take you at church, or perhaps they take the whole church away in the back of several large vans, let's say. And then this raises the issue, when they do arrest you, how many members of the police will they send? Like when they came to arrest Christ, there were scores of them. And here's Jesus saying, you know, I was teaching in the temple and you never came and look at this, armed to the teeth. And this passage says, they shall deliver you up to be afflicted. So the arrest is not only part of affliction or persecution or tribulation, but here it's presented as a prelude to greater persecution. They will arrest you in order to persecute you. And remember, when we're going through this section, the nature of persecution, the question ought to be surfacing in our mind now, how is this going to go down with other Christians in the congregation or denomination or in the neighborhood or the country? How are people going to react to that? Because in general, when something big happens, let's just set aside persecution just for a moment, something big happens in your family or something momentous happens in a country, people have different responses, and one party goes this way, another one goes that way, and there are different ideas. And then it's every man for himself, and the devil take the hindmost, because that's the way some are going to react, as we'll see. So there's the arrest here. Persecution or tribulation includes killing, martyrdom. We spoke of different means of killing Christians in persecution in a previous class. Can anyone mention one of them? And preferably even throw in an example.
Sawn asunder.
Sawn asunder, mentioned in Hebrews 11. Okay. Hanging. Anyone remember a famous person who was hung?
Guido.
Guido de Bray and Cyril Lucaris. Burnt at the stake. Latimer and Ridley. Tangela ordeal. I'm surprised nobody mentioned that one, the Tangela ordeal. Remember what island?
Madagascar.
This may be the one and only thing that some people who hear these classes know about Madagascar. And then they'll struggle to remember that word, Tangela. I hope I'm pronouncing it rightly. It's not a common word in our society. Killed by lions in the New Testament era. Ignatius of Antioch. And then, of course, there's not only being killed, but persecution includes the threat of being killed. And St. Patrick, my memory was jogged with the recent St. Patrick's Day. St. Patrick said in his confession, ideally live in the consciousness, I'm paraphrasing it, that death or all sorts of things could happen to me, because he was a wanted man and an endangered man in his missionary work in Ireland in the 5th century AD. And again, when you get Christians being arrested and some Christians being killed publicly, how does the church respond? I mean, some people might run away. Other people might lie low. Other people, it might embolden them. The text refers also to hatred. And you'll notice the order here. So it refers to people being arrested. They'll arrest you and they'll kill you. And ye shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. And here, the way it's presented in terms of the order, it would most naturally suggest that you're going to be hated even after they kill you, so that your memory won't be allowed to sit easy or be honored. They're going to have a go at you and run you down. Not that they can hurt you anymore, but they can hurt others that would be like you. Who is it that's going to hate the martyred Christian in this text? All nations. Ye shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. So the Christian, in the serious degree of persecution spoken in this text, he's going to be martyred for the faith, and then he's going to be hated globally. The object of global hatred. Some of you may remember George Orwell's book, 1984, which includes the two-minute hate. And this character, the enemy of the state, was presented, Emmanuel Goldstein, and everybody would have to go into the cinema, watch this, and then vent their detestation of him. And everybody would enter in, whether they wanted to do so or not. They'd be stirred up to hate this guy. Well, it will not only be the citizens of Oceania in a novel, but all nations. And it won't just last for two nations, and you don't need to go to the cinema. It'll be a universal loathing. So you've been martyred, and then you're in heaven, but people will think of you in the same sort of way they think of Adolf Hitler or Idi Amin. And all you've got to do is take a text like this and just explain it a little bit. And you think health and wealth gospel, easy believism, Arminianism, and you think to yourself, it's nowhere near the scriptures. And some of the things that they could use to conjure up such detestation of the martyred Christian, he had it coming. He was an enemy of the human race. He professed horrible beliefs, let me tell you them. And he goes around and he believes that God speaks to this book. And we've already outlawed it as hate literature. And then, of course, they'll misrepresent you and engage in outright lies. So three things are spoken of: arrested, killed, and hated of all nations. The parallel passages fill out the picture. Luke 21 verse 12. Luke 21 verse 12 says, they shall lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and into prisons. Incarceration. And this was really presumed in the fact that you're going to be arrested. You know, if they're not going to arrest you and immediately kill you, they've got to incarcerate you. So you or your spouse or your children or your parents or fellow church members, they're carted off, arrested, and then they take their, to make it contemporary, they take your biometric data, and now you're in some huge government computer database, and you're given a number, and you are changed out of your own clothes and given prison garb, the orange jumpsuits, let's say, of America. Yep. So then you become a convict. You're a convict. So you're a convert to Jesus Christ, and now you're a convict. And here you are, you're saying, I'm righteous with the righteousness of Jesus Christ. God loves me, and it's as well, because you're hated globally, and you're a criminal. You're low life. Mark 13, verse 9, throws into the picture the imagery and reality of beating. So they're going to beat you with some sort of rods, let's say, just as they beat and whipped Christ, or Paul and Silas at Philippi. Matthew 13 verse 9 mentions a trial. And trials are not very romantic either. So you're arraigned, you're the dock, you're up against top lawyers. In fact, nobody will probably even represent you. The law is against you as a Christian, because it has been written with you in mind specifically to get you. So that's not going to back you up. And the jury is against you. They hate you too. And Mark 13 verse 9 and Luke 21 verse 12 mention that the opposition comes from the false church or pagan religions or the ungodly state. Talks about councils and synagogues and rulers and kings. So this is just explaining from Matthew 24, verse 9, and the parallel passages, the form of the persecution, to repeat some of the things and deal specifically with the texts that are in the Olivet Discourse. Which brings us to this bit, and this is where we really wanted to get to. What then is the response among professing Christians? You see a brother or a sister arrested, imprisoned, put on trial, executed by the world religions or the state, and they've been hated and beaten. How are your friends in the local congregation going to react to this? And then how would people in this church react? And how would I react if someone else was carted off like this? And I'm going to be presupposing in this presentation here that the person is being persecuted for the truth, not out of their own stupidity or wicked behavior, but they're a faithful Christian and they're being gotten at because of the testimony of Jesus Christ, which is also the context in Matthew 24. The first response mentioned in Matthew 20, verse 4, verse 10, is that many will be offended. Many will be offended. And that means many Christians, many professing Christians, are going to be offended. And offended doesn't mean, oh, you said something and I didn't like that and now I'm annoyed with you. Offended in the Bible means made to fall into sin. So they will see you being persecuted, let's say, and then they back away, and to put it in one word, they apostatize. They say, I didn't sign up to this. I don't want this. That's too much. Now, we could mention here that some people will recant, but then recant their recantation. Can you think of anyone in church history who recanted? That is, under pressure or seeing what happened to other people being persecuted, they recant, they deny Christ.
Cranmer.
Archbishop Cranmer in England in the 16th century. A century before that, Jerome of Prague. And then he recanted his recantation and was burnt at the stake. But this reference to people being offended or falling into sin means especially that many will apostatize completely and finally, either at their own persecution and so escape. Although interestingly, there were various times the Roman church was persecuting somebody, then the person abjured, groveled, and rejected Christ completely and believed the heresy of the Church of Rome, and they still killed him because they thought, I don't think he really means it. He might just recant his recantation. We'll burn him. But others will apostatize completely and finally, others in the church, when they see the persecution of other people. That's enough for them. They don't need to feel the heat of the flames. They see the heat of the flames of somebody else and they call it a day. And this ought not surprise us because people apostatize for incredibly little. Never mind the threat of death. Can you think of some of the things in the Bible or church history for which people have given up Jesus Christ? In the book of Genesis, think of a dainty dish. Esau, bowl of soup. That was enough for him. He was really hungry. Paris, who is famously said to have denied Jesus Christ and become a Roman Catholic for the sake of Paris. Henry IV, Paris is worth a mass. I'll bow down to the wafer and deny Christ and all the instruction I received in my youth. People today, they get a girlfriend or a boyfriend, or they seek to retain their girlfriend or boyfriend and then say, well, I'll just give up being a Christian because I'm really desperate. Yeah, you are desperate. You are really desperate. Or a job on the Lord's Day. It's the job I've always wanted. Or I can't afford to be unemployed. and they give it up. And if people are struggling to hold on to Jesus Christ when you have lesser things like this, when persecution cuts in, people, well, they just fold like a pack of cards, just immediately. So many will be offended. And this is actually what has happened, sadly, in the history of martyrdom and persecution of the churches. Many were offended. They packed it in. The next thing that's mentioned in verse 10, after "then shall many be offended," it goes on to say, "and shall betray one another." And generally, this is a wicked human response under pressure in order to save one's own stinking skin. Many people betrayed others during the Spanish Inquisition, under the Nazis, under the communists. There were people ratting on each other, your neighbor, your family member, left, right, and center. And to quote Orwell's 1984 again, there's the famous line, "Under the spreading chestnut tree, I sold you and you sold me." They both betrayed each other to Big Brother. Betrayal. It happens among professing Christians when they're under pressure, but there's also the famous instance involving a hired traitor. I'm thinking here of Henry Phillips. So he was an Englishman who was an agent of Henry VIII and or Sir Thomas More. Don't believe the propaganda, he was an ungodly wretch. And or John Stokesley, the Bishop of London. And Henry Phillips, sort of a ne'er-do-well waster of a guy who'd made a whole lot of financial blunders, he journeyed to Antwerp in order to locate and ingratiate himself to William Tyndale. He was an agent of the Roman Church. And he pretended to be a Christian, to believe the gospel of free forgiveness of sins in the blood of Christ. And went with Tyndale, "Come on, let's go out for a walk here." And then he led him down an alleyway and the prearranged, and then the guards took him, and he was martyred some months later outside Brussels. So sometimes the traitor is a plant. But ordinarily, and here, it especially refers to professing Christians who are already in the camp when the persecution comes, because it says they shall betray one another. Let's turn now to Mark 13, verse 12, which adds an interesting point to this, and a particularly painful point. Mark 13, verse 12. "Now the brother shall betray the brother to death, and the father the son, and children shall rise up against their parents, and shall cause them to be put to death." So there's betrayal in the same family. Family betrayal. You get family salvation and family covenant and so forth. Then you get family betrayal. Well, here we have the siblings. So imagine a brother or a sister saying, "Well, I only went to church because my sister asked me to come, and I never really believed it. I just came to keep him happy." "Oh, you're okay. And where does he live?" Or intergenerational in the family. The parents grass on the children. The children grass on the parents. You get a child who says, to get his neck out of the noose, as it were, "Well, I only went to catechism because my parents forced me. That was really the only reason I went. They made me do it." And of course, the way things are set up today, from that one charge, that they could probably nail you for child abuse. "You mean your parents sent you to hear about Jesus Christ, that horrible religion? That constitutes child abuse." Now, if they'd have sent you to do something good and wholesome, like to go into a local library to watch a drag queen twerking, well, that would have been all right. But they sent you to a Bible class. We'll have to throw the book at them. And it refers to siblings doing each other in, or parents and children. So that's the household. Betraying each other to death. That phrase is mentioned twice in Mark 13, verse 12. To death. Any thoughts about that? That it could be your physical bloodline, brother, sister, son, daughter, father, mother?
It's pretty awful, but it fits with something Paul says, I think, one of the epistles. Without natural affection.
That's a good example of somebody being without natural affection. It certainly is. And Christ, on a different occasion, quotes Micah, saying a similar thing about people betraying each other. Luke 21, verse 16, brings in another party. Luke 21, verse 16. And ye shall be betrayed both by parents and brethren, and now a new reference, and kinsfolks, so maybe your uncle or your cousin or your granny, and friends. So fellow church members, people you used to worship with, people you were close with, people you used to go to a congregational dinner with or a barbecue or go for a walk or have them around to your house, they will betray you too, some of them. Can anyone think of a psalm that deals with that sort of thing?
55.
Psalm 55, Ivan. Yes, Psalm 55. His words were smoother than butter, but he was a traitor. It was armed. He was armed to the teeth with swords, as it were. And that was a particularly painful thing, because if it had been somebody I didn't know or an enemy that had betrayed me, I could have borne it. But it was you, my equal. One more thing, as well as people apostatizing, people betraying one another. Matthew 24, verse 10 says, here's another response. They shall hate one another. So persecution hits the church. And then, how's everybody going to react? Well, some apostatize. Some rat on their brothers or sisters, including families and friends. And other people hate each other. Now, the previous verse, verse 9, talks about hatred as well. The Christian being hated of all nations because of his faithfulness to the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, our Savior and Redeemer. But verse 10 says, they shall hate one another. So this is hatred from fellow professing Christians or former professing Christians. So there's suspicion, there's malice, there's detestation. And I hate him because he brought me to church and I became a member, and now I'm in trouble because of him. And you try to distance yourself from it as much as possible and wash your own hands and make everybody else look dirty and bad, so that they take the rap and you get off scot-free. The effects of persecution. I mean, it isn't pretty. There are accounts of martyrdoms like Fox's Book of Martyrs and so forth, and they emphasize, and they're true. They mention some of the awful sufferings too, but they particularly focus on the one who was persecuted, their faithful witness, and they mention other people who are brought to faith through that witness or strengthened in their own conviction. And those are 21st century. Those are stories that need to be told, but there's other aspects to it. And Matthew 24, 9 through 13 brings in this other unfashionable side, because after all, persecution isn't persecution at all unless it's really painful, nasty, and involves huge losses. It has to be that for it to be persecution. Persecution also results in what I've called theological opportunism. I'll explain that in a little while. So here you've got these times of hardship and tribulation. Christians being arrested, imprisoned, tried, beaten, killed by the state or some ungodly religion. Some people react by apostatizing. Others betray their erstwhile brethren, including family members doing in each other and friends turning on each other. And there's mutual hatred. But others, Matthew 24 verse 11 says, others will display opportunism theologically. This is their way out. Theological opportunism. And here at this point, persecution is a meeting point of an aspect of anthropology, total depravity, ecclesiology, the doctrine of the church, and eschatology, the doctrine of the last things. Because Matthew 24 verse 11, in its context, you get persecution, verse 9, here's how some people respond, verse 10, and then it says, and many false prophets shall arise. And in this context, it's telling us that some people will be or become leaders, and they're going to change their theological views under the persecution. I mean, this is exactly what you'd expect if you had a wee bit of time to think about. And then some people will follow the theological views of their former or new theological leaders, because they kind of realize that these views might get them out of their persecution. So they sort of want to be deceived. And you'll meet people, I guess, in your life. They actually want somebody to give them any sort of a plausible reason to justify what they know fine well is wrong. That's actually a large part of the origin of heretics. Somebody once said, for instance, if there was no Roman Catholic Church tomorrow, somebody'd have to invent it. You'd have to invent something that claimed to be Christian and historical and yet meant that you could live like the devil and it would require very little of you. And then yet some people thinking that it didn't require much of them, if they want, they can become super saints and enter a monastery, let's say. So it's got something of everything to keep everybody happy. It's part of the genius of the Roman Catholic Church. So I'll give you some examples to make this more concrete. In Central Europe, especially in the Habsburg lands in and around Austria, during the Counter-Reformation, there were Protestants who were being persecuted, and then they would send in the Jesuits. Here you are, you're being persecuted, your church has been closed down, various people have been killed, and you're suffering all sorts of hardships. And now along comes Mr. Sweetness and Light, and he comes along and he says, well, you know, the Roman Catholic Church, we're actually quite right here. And then people are more receptive because they realize if they agree what this Jesuit's telling them, that they'll be able to keep their farm and that their daughter won't be killed. Nice. Yeah, you know, I never realized your arguments were just so good. And you know, there's not really a big pile of difference between what I believed in from my Hussite upbringing or my Lutheran views or the Reformed confession. They're fairly similar. And we were making too big a deal of it, and I can see that you sent in the troops and massacred people from my village, and you really meant it for our good to bring us back to Mother Church. Thank you. Yes, I'll see you at Mass on Sunday morning. Here's a second example, the Camisards. Most people think that name Camisard came from the peasant shirt that they used. These Huguenots in the south of France, round about 1700, so we're back to Louis XIV and Rome. So these Camisards in southern France, their leaders have been killed or fled the country, and then they suffered an outbreak of charismania. So they lacked educated leaders, people who were trained, and the next thing you know, they started to get dreams. Oh, here we go. And in the dreams, The dreams would tell them all sorts of stuff, and you think to yourself, well, wasn't that handy? The dreams would tell them that they should start an army and go and fight back. The dreams would tell them, on and on, on it went. And then the dreams got wackier and crazier, and the people were led away from the scriptures. And these were called, by people outside the country, the French prophets, because they claimed direct illumination. And then they caused havoc, actually, these people later on when they left the south of France and France and went into other Protestant churches. But you've got people who are hunted and hungry, and then some guy comes and he says he got a dream. Well, that's Matthew 24, verse 11. After the references to persecution and how people respond, in verse 10, you have other people responding. Many false prophets shall arise and shall deceive many. Which makes me consider professing Christians. Let's consider professing Christians, and when the wide camp, the wide big tent framework here, Christians in inverted commas, when they're persecuted, as especially as the end approaches. Here's somebody who's into easy believism, and then persecution comes. His religion has taught him to do what? The gospel means everything to be easy for you, and it's easy in, easy out. I mean, he's a candidate. He's a candidate to apostatize. Someone entering these desperate times who is an advocate of the health and wealth gospel. So he gets up each morning and his chief thought, this is his meditation, sets him up for the day. God wants me to be happy, healthy, and wealthy. And then comes persecution, especially at the end. Let's say you've got the kingdom of the beast. The only way to be happy, healthy, and wealthy, but he's been told to set his affections upon in this world, the only way in that system, as he sees it, is to join the kingdom of the beast. Picture someone who has been taught post-millennialism. So there's this future golden age that's coming before Jesus Christ returns, and the whole world's going to be Christianized. And then this happens. Well, he's going to be in all sorts of confusion. Is God's word true? Because God's word said this was coming. And then this came. This other thing.
Well, I think the post-millennialists will think that the king of the Antichrist really is the kingdom they've been waiting for. They'll be sucked into it and they'll think this isn't a bad guy after all. He's bringing peace and reconciliation throughout the whole world. And he's doing away with all the poverty. And this must be the kingdom that we were looking for.
Let's move from Matthew 24, verse 11. We've looked at 9, 10, 11 now. We're into verse 12. Matthew 24, verse 12. More painful effects of persecution. These five verses, bringing in verse 13, are a key passage tonight. We brought in other bits from elsewhere. But if you thought the painful effects of persecution are over, well, there's more to come. Here it is. Because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax old. So here's iniquity, literally lawlessness. It is abounding. And this would include the iniquity of the world with its false religions. It's developing in its own sin generally with its idolatry, its sexual perversion, its blasphemies, its Lord's Day breaking, and all the rest. And now here it's developing in its sin of persecuting the church. So the world is becoming more actively and visibly wicked. But the passage especially deals with the iniquity of the professing church under persecution. Apostasy, betrayal, hatred, false prophets, and false prophecy, with many being engaged in these things. In Matthew 24, verse 12, as this causal link, because iniquity shall abound, it's increasing, it's multiplying, it's abounding, the love of many shall wax cold. And at this stage you're thinking, well, many go wrong here, and many go off here, and many, I mean, is there anybody left? Well, there's still, there must be somebody, because many of the ones that are left are going now too. So you have the apostasy of verse 10. Many leave the faith, many betray each other, many hate each other. More apostasy in verse 11, many false prophets arising, many people deceived. Then verse 12, the love of many waxing cold. So you have sort of like three waves here. And they talk about the three waves of charismaticism and renewal, with each wave getting worse than the one before. Well, here you've got three waves of apostasy. Verse 10, verse 11, verse 12. And when it refers to the love of many waxing cold, this is describing spiritual hypothermia. Spiritual hypothermia. So the green policies in the UK are resulting in increased hypothermia, especially the further north you go, because people can't afford the heat. It's gone, because prices have gone through the roof and their electricity bills are skyrocketing. But this is dealing with spiritual hypothermia. And not just people getting cold, but people dying of this cold. And when it says the love of many wax cold, it means their professed love. They didn't really love the triune God, didn't really love the gospel, didn't really love the kingdom of Jesus Christ. And because iniquity abounds, the love of many waxes cold. So their professed love, persecution, hardships, loss comes in, and it just becomes cold. There's just nothing there. There never was any true love, but the professed love has ended. Just cold. Cold towards it. And again, the application of this now, in our day, is that people's love and the love of many is growing cold now, even when we're not under severe persecution in the West, because we're not compared to this or compared to other parts of the world. So for many people, you don't even need to bring in persecution, the severe persecution. The love of many goes cold now in the church too. You've got the love of money, which is the root of all kinds of evil, 1 Timothy 6. You've got the inordinate and sinful love of the family, whereby you compromise the truth of Jesus Christ. Okay, just to keep your family on side, which Jesus rebukes in Matthew 10, verse 37. You've got the love of your own life. You've got the love of the praise of men. And then you've got antinomianism, because Jesus said, if anyone says he loves me, keep my commandments, but he doesn't really. And then 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 10, speaks about the love of the truth, and they don't actually love the truth at all. And then persecution comes, and they just cave in. So, yeah. Perhaps we could put it like this, to quote Romans 8, verse 35. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation, or distress, or persecution, or famine, or nakedness, or peril, or sword? No. None of those things separate us from the love of Christ. That is, Christ will still love us. But persecution and those other things will show if we really love Christ. And if we don't love Christ, then it's revealed when it's evident that we never were his in the first place. He never knew us. Any thoughts on that?
Parable of the sword.
The parable of the sword, Julian says.
Matthew 12:21. He has no root in himself. He endureth for a while, but when tribulation or persecution arises, he's offended.
Now, how does Matthew 24, the passage we're looking at, and the parallel passages, how do they apply to us? Well, we have here some exhortations. Mark 13, verse 9 begins this section. But take heed to yourselves, for they shall deliver you up to councils, etc. And then it goes on to speak about persecution and tribulation. Take heed to yourselves. You need to be very careful especially in days of persecution, whether from the false church or the state, because you're going to undergo danger, if not outright pain, and you will be tempted to apostasy and to embrace false prophecy as a way of escape. Take heed to yourselves. Take heed to yourselves now, and especially when this comes. Take heed. You say, well, I didn't need Mark 13 verse 9 to say, take heed to yourselves. When I was hearing all this, I was taking heed to myself, and I thought, I could nearly have guessed that this was going to be the exhortation. Yeah, and that just shows that it's a very natural exhortation. It flows from the passage. Here's Luke 21 verse 19. Luke 21 verse 19 says, and it comes at the end of Luke's treatment of this. In your patience, possess ye your souls. In your patience, possess ye your souls. And this text is telling us that you must remain under in your calling as a Christian. You're under God, you're under His Word. God has placed you in His providence under hardships, and you must, in your patience, in your remaining under it, you must hold out without sinfully avoiding tribulation by apostasy or selling out your brethren. And this is the way to possess your souls in this world and the next, so as to obtain your inheritance in Jesus Christ in the world to come. So exhortations: take heed to yourselves, watch your spiritual life now, and be careful, and don't fold, be patient, persevere, and that's the way to retain and possess your soul.
There is a legitimate time to flee too.
There is a legitimate time to flee, and that was why I said very carefully that without sinfully avoiding tribulation, because I was mindful of the bit that there is a time to flee. And many of the martyrs actually did flee earlier in their lives. But then there came a time when they couldn't. Or like Latimer in that case, they thought, look, I'm an old man. This is probably the best way to go. We talked earlier about earlier in these classes, not tonight, of the Marian martyrs. And when Bloody Mary came to the throne, a whole host of men fled. There's the Marian martyrs and the Marian exiles. So they went to Europe and they ended up in places like Frankfurt and Geneva. And then they learned the Reformed faith more strongly and purely and firmly. And then when Bloody Mary met her end, then they came back and they brought a better, deeper, fuller version of Christianity back to the British Isles. So there was a clear example of fleeing. They left the country. They could see the writing on the wall. And they also thought, there's good seminaries over there and we can learn stuff. So off they went. But some had to stay. So those are exhortations. Let's consider the two promises. Luke 21 verse 18. Luke 21 verse 18 says, and this sounds a bit strange, but there shall not an hair of your head perish. There shall not an hair of your head perish. Now, Luke 21, verse 12 says, they're going to lay hands on you, persecute you, deliver up to the synagogues and to prisons, brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake. Verse 16, you're going to be betrayed by parents, brethren, kinsfolks, friends. Some of you they'll put to death. Verse 17, you shall be hated of all men for my name's sake, but there shall not an hair of your head perish. You say, but I thought we're going to suffer all this. It means it's all in God's providence. You're not forgotten by God, even in the tiniest bit, not even one of your hairs. But let's close with Matthew 24, verse 13. which is found in the parallel passage of Mark 13, verse 13, because Matthew 24, verse 13 is the end of this section that we've been focusing on tonight, our chair passage, Matthew 24, verses 9 through 13. It states, "But he that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved." What do you think the end means here? The end.
Christ's return.
Yes, it means end as in goal. No, it means the end of your life, and that's God's, but especially the end as in the end of the world with Christ's second coming, of which this persecution is a sign, especially as the persecution gets worse. So he that shall endure to the end, he who presses on without giving up, even though people may be falling left, right, and center, he who presses on will be saved. And this is the perseverance of the saints, and the perseverance of the saints through persecution, through the persecution of the saints. So those who endure to the end, the perseverance of the saints through the persecution of the saints, they will be saved. A future salvation, you're already saved, but you will be saved with full, complete messianic salvation, eternal life, and the bliss of perfect communion with Christ. Do you have any thoughts about the word he in verse 13? And by the way, it's nothing to do with males. The males are going to continue, but the females are going to wilt. That's not the point. It's he or she would serve the point. What does it not say? It doesn't say they that shall endure unto the end shall be saved. Although there will be more than one, obviously. And it doesn't say many that shall endure. These many will be saved. It talks about many being offended, many betraying each other, many hating one another, many false prophets, many being deceived, and so forth. And then it talks about, but he who endures to the end shall be saved.
The narrow way.
It's a narrow way. And it's an individual struggle. And the Christian says, even if others go, I'm not going to follow their lead. He that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved. Not some other guy that doesn't endure to the end. The person who endures is the person who shall be saved. And this is a promise especially needed during persecution, and a promise that's especially precious during persecution, that you've got to keep thinking about if it comes right down to it, because the devil will say to you, well, you know, you should just compromise a little and you have to save your own skin after all. And then the Bible says, but he that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved. And it won't do for me to keep the faith for 3 months and then fold. You've got to endure to the end. And those who endure to the end be saved, which means those who don't endure to the end won't be saved. That'd be a great subject to deal with in a big charismatic church. You know, say the congregation, the building was half full, and you just explained like a passage like that, and you had the big charismatic church, and the building was half full, and next week the building would be completely full. That's what would happen, isn't it? Next week there'd be you and your wife.
Do you think, Joe, in those days, churches who teach a false Christ, who appeals to the masses,
yes,
will continue to just grow? Like, there won't be a, like, we see a falling away of, oh, you know, don't mention Christ's name, okay, and then they just all fall away. But a false church that teaches a false Christ anyway has no effect to the Antichrist and his kingdom, therefore go on ahead, teach this false Christ.
Yes, in general persecution, a false Christ which isn't too offensive, that church could grow, because then they'll deal with the true Christians. And then when the Antichrist comes and things are final, people will suddenly, and lo and behold, realize that the one that they've been worshipping was actually that guy who's the leader of the one world kingdom. And we, and it was so good of him to tell us. And really, we were serving him all along, and we're glad that he's come. Brian?
There won't be any even false churches at the end. Because
at the very end, yes.
At the very end, because they'll all be churches of Antichrist, all of them, every one of them.
Yep.